Also, please, everyone, pick up a flyer in the front. Schedule of our upcoming events. We have a whole bunch of people coming in. Next week, actually next Tuesday, we have a gentleman by the name of William Pepper, who's a British barrister, who was Martin Luther King's attorney, and is a very close friend of the King family, who has a book called An Act of State. That'll be next Tuesday. And C-SPAN Television actually will be here to film the event for future broadcast on Book TV. And we have one of the Sopranos come in and a whole bunch of people. So please pick this up, give us your email address, and we'll keep you updated. The format tonight, Scott will be out in just a few minutes. He'll make some opening remarks, and then he really wants to open it up for questions. So feel free to ask him whatever you like. He'll answer anything. He'll repeat the question, so just please shout it out, and he'll repeat it for the benefit of everyone else. And then after that, we have a book signing. You can meet Scott once again. The book signing will be right here. I just ask that everybody just go around that way and just come back in, and we exit this way. If you don't have a book, we have books in the front. It's $13, a bargain for what it is. It's a great book. I've actually read it. So do check it out. So if everyone is comfortable, please welcome Mr. Scott Ritter.
Well,
yeah, that's
okay, we'll see if we can make this work. First of all, thank you very much for coming tonight. Certainly is an honor and a privilege to be here and to talk to you about an issue that, you know, regardless of where you stand on the matter, no one can debate that it's not one of the more defining moments of our time, the issue of war and peace and whether or not our nation is going to, in fact, engage in a war that may cost us thousands of lives of our own soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marine, and may cost the lives of many tens of thousands of Iraqis. I think we have a duty and responsibility as American citizens, before we head down the path towards war, to, you know, take the time. We owe it to those who wear the uniform, who serve our country so proudly, to take the time to debate, discuss, engage in an open dialogue about this issue. Is there a cause worthy of war? Is there justification for the sacrifice we're asking these brave patriots to make in our name? And we should never forget that. Those who wear the uniform of the United States of America wear our uniform. They're our soldiers. They're our sailors. They're our Marines. And therefore, we have a duty and a responsibility as American citizens to insist that those whom we elect to higher office exhaust every venue possible short of war before going to war. So that's one of the main reasons why I wrote the book Endgame, is to discuss the issue in Iraq, to lay out my perceptions regarding the nature of Iraq, the nature of its brutal, tyrannical regime. Under no circumstances should anybody ever misconstrue my opposition to a war with Iraq as somehow being sympathetic to the tyrant Saddam Hussein. There is no sympathy in my heart for the tyrant Saddam Hussein. My heart goes out to America, to the United States of America, to the Constitution for which we stand, and for those who serve our country so proudly. Those are whom I'm out here demonstrating on behalf of. I'm also demonstrating on behalf of international law and the concept of law. And I should remind everybody that, you know, when we speak of international law, it isn't necessarily in direct opposition to the concept of American law. In fact, when you read the Constitution, and I'm a big fan of the Constitution, Article 6 of the Constitution says that when we sign or enter into an agreement that has been ratified by two-thirds of the U.S. Senate, that is the law of the land here in America. We are signatories to the United Nations Charter, and therefore we are obliged to abide by the United Nations Charter. And we should never forget that the United Nations Charter forswears war as a means of resolving disputes between nations. That the ideal manner in which we do resolve these is through the process of law. Now, the United Nations Charter does recognize that situations may exist that threaten international peace and security. That's why the United Nations Charter creates the Security Council. And it says that the Security Council under Chapter 7 of the Charter can determine that a threat to international peace and security exists that warrants military intervention. But when we take a look at what's happening with Iraq today,
you'll see that the United States is pushing aggressively forward on the issue of going to war and not paying due heed to the will of the Security Council. The Council has mandated the return of weapons inspectors. Indeed, weapons inspectors are in Iraq today. It's not a black and white situation. Will Iraq comply or won't they? It's way too early in the process to tell what the final outcome of the inspection process will be. But what is clear is that the will of the international community, the will of the Security Council, is that we must give the inspectors time, all the time necessary to finish their job before we talk about going to war. And yet the United States is pushing forward. We run the very dangerous potential of us getting involved in a military action in Iraq void of international support, operating outside the framework of international law. What this means is a couple things. A, that when we engage with Iraq, we will not only and get ourselves involved in the conflagration in that nation, but we will also destabilize the entire region, condemning the United States to perpetual conflict for years to come, a conflict that can only mean bad things, not only for our nation, but the world at large. Two, and I say this as a former Marine who spent 12 years proudly wearing that uniform, serving my country, having fought in the first Gulf War, we will be sending hundreds of thousands of our service members off to fight in a war that will not have the full support of the American people. This is a shame. Didn't we learn our lesson in Vietnam? You know, it's those who wear the uniform of the United States military are not to blame for the policies of the government. They're out there serving our country, and it's incumbent upon us as a people to give them our full support, but it has to be in a cause worthy of support. That is why I believe these demonstrations that swept the nation over this weekend said not only no to war, but they also said yes to international law. I believe the majority of the American people would regretfully support military action against Iraq if we had the full support of the international community, if there was a cause, if Iraq was found to be in violation of its obligations, if Iraq was found to be a threat to the United States. All of this may be. The future may uncover weapons of mass destruction, uncover plotting by Saddam Hussein against our country. And if that is the case, woe be it to Saddam Hussein and Iraq, because war will come with all the horror of war. But we cannot prejudge the outcome. And not only that, we cannot only limit ourselves to the concept of a military solution. We must open ourselves up to, you know, thinking about alternatives to war, how we can resolve this problem short of war. And that's why I called the book Endgame, Solving the Iraq Crisis, because war is not an endgame. War is a path to nowhere. War is about death and destruction. War, you know, represents basically a failure of mankind, because war is about human beings killing human beings. Unfortunately, we are human, and sometimes we head down that path. But I would like to believe that, again, because we are human, because we are thinking beings, that we can come up with solutions to this problem that do not require us to stain the moral character of the United States of America by engaging in a needless conflict. Endgame, Solving the Iraqi Crisis, speaks of opening up the possibility of diplomatic solutions, taking a look at alternatives such as diplomatic engagement, liberating the Iraqi people not through an invasion but through the lifting of economic sanctions, and considering a whole host of other options that will improve the human rights of Iraq. And remember, human rights is a two-way street. It's not simply about Saddam Hussein oppressing the Iraqi people. That is definitely an equation that must be dealt with. Iraq must conform to internationally accepted standards of human rights. But it's also about the international community understanding the international community's obligation to the Iraqi people by lifting economic sanctions, by ensuring that the Iraqi people can spend their national resources the way they see fit. It's a complicated question, and there's no simple solution. But believe me, sitting down, debating, discussing this issue, coming up with alternatives short of war, is what we owe not only to those who wear the uniform, but to everyone who calls himself an American. Because America does stand for something. It stands for freedom. It stands for liberty. It stands for values, ideals that we must adhere to if we are to call ourselves Americans. So again, thank you for being here tonight. I'll be more than happy to take questions from anybody. Yes, ma'am. Okay, the question is, am I familiar with the U.S. House bill, and I don't know the number, H.R. 2459, to establish a Department of Peace. I believe Dennis Kucinich, the representative. Right. No, I am familiar with it. I'm very familiar with Representative Kucinich. I'm going to be brutally honest here. I'm a former Marine. I'm a warrior, not a pacifist, although I'm now pushing a path towards peace because I do know what war is, and I understand its horrors. Anything we can do to develop a framework of thinking, of a process within the bureaucracy of the U.S. government that promotes peace. Right now, it seems that the United States government is, unbalanced in the direction of resolving conflicts, resolving crises through military force. We've given up the concept of engagement, discussion, diplomacy, and we go to the gun quicker than maybe we should. So, yeah, I think a Department of Peace might be a good idea. I'm not a bureaucrat. I'm not an expert on U.S. government and how that such a department would be formed, but I just think the concept of promoting peace before we promote war would be a sound policy.
Could I just ask you one favor? Because you were on Phil Donahue, you must know Phil Donahue. Could you tell him to please have Kucinich on his show and start talking about it, get a debate going?
Well, I'll do my best, but I can't say that I have a direct link with Mr. Donahue. Okay, yes, sir. Could I clarify why weapons inspectors left Iraq in 1998? I can, but I'm going to put it in a broader context. For inspections to work in Iraq, we have to understand there's three conditions. One, Iraq must fully comply with its obligation to disarm. Iraq has an obligation to fully cooperate with the weapons inspectors. Void of Iraqi cooperation, you cannot have a successful inspection. Two, the Security Council, in passing laws that require inspectors to go to work and disarm Iraq, must be willing to enforce that law. So if you run into a situation where Iraq is not in compliance, you must be willing to step up to the plate and enforce your law. What good's a law unless it's enforced? And three, if you're going to hold Iraq accountable to the rule of law, say you must disarm, we have to ensure that those who implement the rule of law, the weapons inspectors themselves, are held accountable to the rule of law. That is, when you go into Iraq to disarm Iraq, that is what your mandate is, to get rid of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. There is no Security Council resolution authorizing regime removal. In fact, if you study not only all Security Council resolutions, you'll find that there is no mention of regime removal, but read the United Nations Charter. It specifically prohibits regime removal. And again, I come back to Article 6 of the Constitution. We're signatories of the United Nations Charter. So when you hear the president say our policy in Iraq is regime removal, what the president is saying is our policy in Iraq is in violation of international law and in violation of the Constitution of the United States of America. Now, having said that, we come to 1998. We're in a situation where Iraq is not fully cooperating. No one should ever forget that there was not full cooperation by the Iraqi government from 1991 to 1998. Two, the Security Council was unwilling to back up the inspectors, wasn't willing to step up to the plate. But three, the United States had a policy of regime removal that had been in place since 1991 that corrupted the integrity of the inspection operation. The United States used the weapons inspectors and the unique access inspections afforded the inspectors to the most sensitive sites inside Iraq to spy on Saddam's security, to gather information about Saddam Hussein's security, and to use that information actively to foment his overthrow. From 1993 to 1998, there were five CIA-sponsored assassination/coup attempts against Saddam Hussein that used intelligence information derived from the inspection process. So we had a very complicated situation. In December 1998, the United States manipulated the inspection process one last time. They put weapons inspectors in Iraq. Again, Richard Butler, the Australian diplomat who headed the weapons inspection process, ordered the inspectors in, but he did it in a hand-in-glove relationship with Sandy Berger, the National Security Advisor. They coordinated timelines of inspection with timelines of military action. They sent the weapons inspectors in to be deliberately provocative. To define this, understand that from 1996 to 1998, we had an agreement with the Iraqis about inspecting sensitive sites. They're called the modalities for sensitive site inspections. It meant that if we went to a site that Iraq felt was dealt with its national security, we would limit the number of inspectors going in to four. And then if the inspectors found anything relevant to their work, all the inspectors could come in. If the inspectors didn't find anything, if it was simply an intelligence facility, a security facility, then the inspection was done. This agreement was in place, and it worked. The United States instructed Richard Butler to scrap the modalities of sensitive site inspections without going to the Security Council. So the inspector showed up in Iraq, went to a facility in downtown Baghdad. The Iraqis said, come on in with the modalities. This is a sensitive site because it was the Ba'ath Party headquarters. It had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, everything to do with Iraq's political sensitivities. Iraq said, though, you can inspect it. They even said you can bring in, I think, up to 16 inspectors. But the weapons inspectors, said no. We're going to scrap the modalities. We'll go in, but the modalities don't apply. We'll just come in. The Iraqis said, I'm sorry, the agreement is the modalities apply. The inspectors refused to back down on Richard Butler's orders. And when the Iraqis said, without the modalities, you can't come in, the inspectors were withdrawn. And what the world was told is that Iraq refused to cooperate with the weapons inspectors. The United States then ordered the inspectors out of Iraq, and 24 hours later began bombing Iraq, Operation Desert Fox, a 72-hour bombing campaign, 97 targets, 86 of which dealt with Saddam Hussein's security. All 86 were derived from weapons inspectors' intelligence reports. Yes, sir. Okay, the question related to this massive deployment of military forces that we see both here on the West Coast and also on the East Coast, and believe me, the soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines are coming from the hinterlands too. All across America, American troops are deploying to the region. Do I believe that the United States is listening to the inspectors, is willing to give the inspections a chance, or are we just moving towards war? Well, it's hard. You know, I'm not a member of the Bush administration, obviously, so I can't tell you what the inside thinking is. There's a lot of people out there that say, oh, Bush is just bluffing. You know, and many congressmen and senators say, you know, if we don't show the Iraqis that we're serious, they'll never cooperate. So this is probably the most expensive game of chicken ever played. But the problem with this game of chicken is it's not a game. We're talking about war. And I have to tell you, knowing what I know about military deployments, having participated in a massive deployment of troops to the Persian Gulf in 1990, 1991, at some point in time, this military deployment will take on a life of its own. You will deploy so much military equipment, so much personnel, you will commit so much political, diplomatic, and economic resources to this deployment that you simply cannot pull back. You will achieve a critical mass, which means war is all but inevitable. And the danger of this is that the buildup of American military power is not coinciding with the buildup of international support for this war. In fact, you have two exact opposite graph lines. As American military power builds up, international support, and indeed domestic support for this war, is declining. The international community said they will not support a war with Iraq without a second Security Council resolution. And the Security Council has said clearly that they will not pass a resolution authorizing war until they have a smoking gun, until the weapons inspectors have come out and said Iraq is not cooperating or Iraq has weapons. So the international community said, give the inspectors a chance. I have to tell you, as a professional weapons inspector for 7 years, give the inspectors a chance means the following: 6 months to a year. The inspectors were out of Iraq for nearly 4 years. When I resigned in 1998, I testified to the U.S. Senate that once you remove weapons inspectors from the equation in Iraq, Iraq could reconstitute significant aspects of its programs within 6 months. They had 4 years to reconstitute it and hide, potentially. I'm not saying they did it. I'm saying the potential's there. And given the stakes at hand here, we have to give the inspectors every opportunity to thoroughly investigate this issue, to do their job. Donald Rumsfeld and others in the administration have denigrated the inspectors, saying they cannot work. But I think, if anything, the events of last week prove the inspectors can work. They found 11 warheads. They found 3,000 pages. They're putting pressure on the Iraqis, and they're doing a good job. We just need to give them more time to do. But the danger is the Bush administration isn't going to be able to give them that time, because we are accelerating this military buildup so that conflict with Iraq seems all but inevitable by the end of February. Yes, sir, in the back. Why do I think the Clinton administration and Sandy Berger did what they did in 98? Let's first of all remember that they inherited this situation. I'm not a big fan of Bill Clinton, But with all due respect to him, he inherited the situation. He didn't create this situation. He inherited it from the first President Bush, who left an unresolved situation that talked about dealing with Iraq by containing Iraq, not solving the problem. So he inherited a problem of containment. You know, when Bill Clinton first came into office, he made a statement. He said, "I'm a good Southern Baptist and I believe in deathbed conversions, and maybe we can just get Saddam Hussein to change his ways." And as soon as he said that, all American politicians, Democrat and Republican, slapped him down, because Saddam Hussein had been demonized to such an extent in the political psyche of the American people that, you know, engagement with Saddam Hussein was inconceivable politically. Any politician who said, "Hey, let's maybe reopen diplomatic relations with Iraq and solve this thing diplomatically," feared for their political future. So Clinton continued this policy of containment. But containment isn't a policy. Containment is the absence of policy. Containment means we don't know what we're doing to solve this situation, so we're just going to put a big circle around it and hold it in place. Containment meant that the Iraqi people are condemned to perpetual suffering because of economic sanctions. Containment meant that the entire region is condemned to perpetual instability because of this American military buildup, this constant toing and froing with Iraq. Containment meant, because we have a policy of regime removal, that until we get rid of Saddam Hussein, there's not a solution. It meant that we closed the door on any possibility of Saddam Hussein cooperating with the inspectors. Because if you say, you know, the international law says that once Iraq cooperates, once Iraq is found to be in compliance, economic sanctions will be lifted. But when the United States has a policy that says no matter what Iraq does, even if they comply, we will not lift sanctions until Saddam Hussein is removed from power, you know, you've suddenly screwed up the entire political, geopolitical, diplomatic equation. Bill Clinton had a problem because every time we had a crisis with Iraq, he wasn't willing to go all the way. I talked about enforcement of law. Let's be serious. When we're talking about enforcing a law that deals with Iraq, we have to make sure that the enforcement affects that which makes the decision in Iraq. And Iraq is a dictatorship. Saddam Hussein is the decision maker. So if you're going to enforce something with Iraq, you have to put pressure on Saddam. You have to threaten his very existence before he'll wake up and understand that they're serious. Bill Clinton was never willing to take it to that level. So Iraq found out that they could get away with obstructing the inspectors. Then the Americans would build up and Iraq would give away just enough to have the buildup go down. So you had this constant cycle of buildup, escalation, de-escalation, and it was very expensive monetarily, and is very damaging politically because Bill Clinton was always raising expectations. So finally, the Clinton administration did the age-old political thing of say one thing, do another. And give you an example, on April 6th, 1998, Bill Clinton spoke to the U.S. Congress and said, "It is the policy of the United States to do everything we can to support the weapons inspectors. Whatever the inspectors say they need, we will provide." And then they turned around and passed a secret U.S. policy that said, "Stop the inspectors from being confrontational." So when I would go into Iraq at the head of a weapons inspection team, fully mandated to do our task with search warrants signed by the United Nations to do the job, we would show up in Iraq and the United States would pull the rug out from under our feet and we couldn't do our job. Bill Clinton did what he did because he didn't have the courage either to decisively confront Iraq on this issue or to recognize that this policy that we had in regards to Iraq was a failure, that we needed new and innovative ways of dealing with Iraq, such as perhaps a more vibrant diplomatic engagement.
Do you think his disdain for the military contributed
to that? Do I think his disdain for the military contributed to that? You know, I think when Bill Clinton became president, he learned a lot about the military he didn't know before he became president. And I don't believe that disdain is reflective of how he treated the military during his 8 years. I'm not a big fan of Bill Clinton, but I think he learned to respect the U.S. military. And I think by the time, you know, he had a couple months under his belt as president, he realized that the military is a proud institution that serves America honorably. And I don't think he did bad by the military. He's, you know, of course, not the military's greatest person, but he, you know, I don't think he had that kind of disdain as president. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Could you tell us what your proud patriotic warriors are doing concerning the IDs they issued to the children they sodomized and the women at Camp Pendleton, Phuket Beach, at Metro Manila, Subic Bay, and the other areas that they molest women and abuse them?
Well, I certainly wouldn't think that it's U.S. policy to promote that. If
they issue IDs, come on, we know.
Well, no, I know nothing about that, so I probably am not in a position to comment on that other than to say that the rule of law is the rule of law. It has to be applied uniformly. If an American military personnel breaks the law, and doesn't, they need to be held fully accountable to it.
So what are you doing about the sex slaves that you've created with the military all over the world?
Again, I can't comment on that, so, you know. Yes, sir.
Scott, I'm concerned about the vulnerability of our troops over there. If we attack Iraq, what is the vulnerability from the standpoint of Saddam Hussein unleashing a biological or a chemical warfare? And what's the mechanism of that? Does he have the delivery capability? What do we have, 20,000 people in Kuwait? Can he knock out those 20,000 people with biological or chemical warfare?
Okay. The question dealt with Iraq's, the vulnerability of our troops to an Iraqi chemical and biological attack. Does Saddam Hussein have the capability of launching a preemptive strike against our thousands of troops deployed? Or even an attack, if we attack? Sure. I think the CIA has issued a report that said that, you know, the biggest risk comes if we invade Iraq. It's very unlikely that Iraq would launch a preemptive strike, et cetera. Well, first thing is, that presumes that Iraq has chemical and biological weapons. You know, a lot of speculation existed about Iraq's chemical and biological weapons program before the inspectors got back in, because everybody said, you know, what do we know what they did in those 4 years where inspectors weren't there? But we have inspectors there now. Weapons of mass destruction are not produced in a vacuum. They're produced by a confluence of industry, science, technology. When you produce a weapon of mass destruction, you leave trace evidence. The inspectors to date have carried out over 400 inspections, including inspections of all the relevant industrial facilities in Iraq that could be used by Iraq to produce chemical and biological weapons, and they found no evidence of Iraqi manufacturing of these weapons. There's no trace evidence. View Iraq as a crime scene. You know, we've suspected Saddam Hussein of the crime of producing or retaining weapons of mass destruction. View the inspectors as crime scene investigators. They are equipped with some of the most sophisticated detection equipment in the world that can detect 1 to 100 millionth of a particle. So go to a chemical facility around San Diego and look how messy these places are. You don't do things with chemicals without leaving spillage around. You can't clean everything up. And these inspectors will find evidence. The CIA had a priority list. We got to see some of it at Americans. Last fall, when Donald Rumsfeld and others briefed us repeatedly, these are the sites that Iraq's rebuilding, that were bombed and Iraq's rebuilding. It's these places where Iraq's building these weapons, and this is why we have to go to war now to hold Iraq accountable, to prevent, you know, a smoking gun or a mushroom cloud. The inspectors have inspected every single one of these sites to date, all the CIA sites of concern, and they've reported nothing's there. So now the question is, what weapons does Iraq have? Well, as long as you have weapons inspectors in Iraq, you know, there's no way they're going to have a viable weapons program. If they did, it would have to be buried someplace in the ground, and eventually the inspectors will find it. And it'll have to be of such a small quantity, because it's not going to be massive in nature, that it's militarily not viable. The biggest danger we face isn't from Iraqi chemical or biological weapons attack. To be honest, you know, biological weapon, the only one that Iraq produced in large numbers that was of any impact was anthrax. It was liquid bulk agent. They never weaponized it properly. The only way an Iraqi biological bomb or shell was going to kill you is if it landed on your head. Because if it missed you, it would just put a hole in the ground, break open, the sludge would break out, spill on the ground, and nothing happens. And their chemical weapons weren't that good either. But there's no evidence they have them. The biggest danger we face is as we close in on Baghdad, we come in on a massive conglomeration of urban concentration. Baghdad is a city the size of Detroit with 5 million people. Surrounding Baghdad are a number of very established urban areas. We're going to have to fight through these areas. That's the number one threat facing American troops in Iraq today, I believe, is urban warfare.
Do you think Saddam Hussein is suicidal? Do you think he'd be willing to accept, you know, realize what we can do to him in 20 minutes or an hour, wipe out all his palaces and so forth? Do you think he's willing to accept that kind of a...
I don't believe Saddam Hussein's suicidal. I believe Saddam Hussein is about one thing and one thing only, and that's the continued survival of Saddam Hussein. But I will tell you this, Saddam Hussein is somebody, he's not going to leave Iraq. I mean, Donald Rumsfeld can wistfully believe that Saddam Hussein is going to run off to exile, but that isn't going to happen. Saddam Hussein will fight, and Saddam Hussein will die in Iraq. And he believes that he can exact a horrendous toll on the United States of America. He believes also that he can hold off the ultimate American victory long enough so that the entire region explodes and that the United States will never be able to, you know, achieve its final objective. And given the limited number of troops that we're talking about here, you know, Rumsfeld is only talking about deploying 250 to 300,000. When we took over Kuwait, it took 600,000. And now we're talking about taking over all of Iraq. And we speak of, you know, precision weapons, new intelligence, et cetera. In a city, all that stuff goes out the window when it comes an infantryman against an infantryman in a confined area, and it's some of the most bloody, horrific fighting imaginable. Yes, sir. Okay. The question centered on the issue of what's my feelings about the veterans. I mean, we went to war in the Gulf War the first time around, and of the 600,000, over 200,000 today are suffering the effects of what's called Gulf War syndrome. Some of it is the effects of exposure to depleted uranium. Some is effective exposure to chemical agent. To be honest, what I'll say is, I don't know enough about it so I can sit here and endorse one finding or the other. I do know that many thousands of our veterans, the people who wear our uniform, the people who serve our country, are ill, and that the United States government has turned its back on these veterans. And now we're talking about going to war again in Iraq, exposing more hundreds of thousands of Americans to things, and we haven't even taken care of the guys who got sick the first time. That's 10,000 have died, and that's, you know, everybody says that the Gulf War didn't cost us anything, only a couple hundred combat deaths. Well, 10,000 brave Americans have died because of Gulf War syndrome. You know, I'm dead set against it. This is why one of the things that I accomplished in Iraq the last time I went was to get the Iraqi government to turn over documents that would facilitate the work of lawyers who are working on behalf of the Gulf War veterans so that they can win compensation from companies that help supply Iraq with weapons of mass destruction. It's a shame that, you know, the Iraqi government has to provide these documents to help American veterans when the U.S. government is turning its back on these veterans and getting ready to expose even more brave Americans to this. I think the American people should wake up. You know, we're a democracy. This is government of the people, by the people, for the people. It's high time we start holding those whom we elect to higher office accountable for what they do in our name. Yes, sir. Okay, in the face of everything that we've said here tonight, why is it the U.S. government is aggressively pushing for war? This is my personal opinion, and you can take it and leave it as you wish. I think that what we have in Washington, D.C. right now, you know, I voted for President Bush. I should say that right up front. Okay.
Yeah.
Mea culpa. But what I'll say is this. You know, I was one of these people that listened to him when he said that he was a uniter, not a divider. Okay, I'm not here making a party speech. I'm just telling you something here. He said he would reach across party lines and build a coalition, etc. But, you know, to do that, a politician has to be comfortable that he has a mandate. And I'll tell you, if we learned anything from the 2000 election, you can say it was stolen or whatever, but however you come out on that, he didn't get a mandate. And what happens to a politician when they don't get a mandate? They fall back on their political base. And unfortunately, the political base for the Republican Party is the far right wing, the neoconservatives. So we have a situation where the president won, stole, whatever, the election. And now he comes into power. And he, in turn, empowers this very narrow fringe element of the Republican Party, the neoconservatives. And now they have hijacked the decision-making hierarchy of the United States of America, and they need to sustain their hold on power. And how does a minority sustain their hold on power over the majority? You create the concept of perpetual war, perpetual crisis. In 9/11, the horrific events of that day were tailor-made for the neoconservatives who had a plan in place ready to go. That's why we have Homeland Security. That's why we have the War on Terror. And the War on Terror obviously wasn't terrifying enough to the American people, so now we need the war on Iraq. That's why we have the national security strategy of the Bush administration, which speaks of American unilateral application of force to respond to problems and issues that arise that we unilaterally define. It's an outright rejection of international law. It's an outright rejection of the framework of law that has held the world together since the end of World War II. This is simply about ideology and promoting ideology. The Iraq War is not about the security of the United States. The Iraq War is about implementation of the Bush Doctrine. And the Bush administration all but admits that the Iraq War will not solve anything. It's going to open up a whole host of new issues. When I spoke to, I had a debate with Richard Perle, who's an advisor to the Bush administration, and Richard Perle and I were talking about the potential outcome of this war. And I said, you know, if we go to war void of international support, there's a good chance that we would destabilize the entire region. And, you know, we have to listen to Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, when he says, if you go to war with Iraq, you will unleash forces inside Egypt that I cannot control. I may not be here. And the king, King Abdullah of Jordan, says the same thing. You know, there's a good chance that all these nations that we currently call friends and allies will collapse and be replaced by anti-American Islamic fundamentalist type governments. And Richard Perle, the moderator, turned and said to Richard Perle, well, Mr. Ritter said something here. How do you handle that? And Richard Perle said, what's the problem? You see, Richard Perle and those who are promoting this doctrine believe that the Middle East is a failed region. They believe that there has to be a revolutionary transformation of power in the Middle East that pulls the Middle East and these Islamic nations out of centuries of feudal theocratic, you know, lockstep into, you know, Western liberal democracy. Well, that's nice, but what does revolutionary transformation of power mean? You know, Lenin used that term when he spoke of transforming the peasantry into the proletariat. And Lenin said, I'm willing to accept millions of deaths to do this. Are we as Americans willing to stand by while our government implements a policy that will result in millions of deaths? I think not. That's what's pushing the Bush administration, though. That's my opinion. Yes, ma'am. Okay, I'll get to you in just a second here, but I'll deal with these two peripherals first. What about oil? I think oil is definitely, it cannot be ignored. I mean, anybody who understands what drives the American economy and drives the international economy knows that it's oil. And oil is, you know, part of the equation of power. But oil isn't the sole thing. I believe that this is about ideology. I mean, oil was there when you had Democrats in office. Oil was there when you had other Republican Party. But we're talking about this fringe wing of the Republican Party, these neoconservatives who are pushing ideology. Oil plays a very important role, but I believe that oil actually exploits the policies of these as opposed to this ideology exploiting oil. I think the ideology is in the lead and oil comes in behind and influences. Now, the nuclear thing. I'm scared to death of this war with Iraq because the Bush administration has put forward a nuclear policy planning document that says that the United States can initiate the use of nuclear weapons in a non-nuclear environment, meaning that it's not about mutually assured destruction anymore. It means that if a scenario develops where we think the use of a nuclear weapon will be to our benefit, then we will use it. One of these scenarios goes as follows, where tens of thousands of American troops are stranded in a hostile land where they are exposed to the potential of chemical and biological warfare. The potential, not the reality, the potential, where they can potentially be attacked by chemical and biological weapons. So now we go to Iraq. We send 250,000 troops in there, and they get bogged down in street fighting. We suffer casualties. We don't have the means to reinforce. The Middle East explodes in a sea of anti-American discontent. The port facilities that we would use to reinforce our troops are cut off, denied to us because of popular unrest. The governments we're looking to for support no longer exist. Islamic fundamentalism has swept the area. Now what do? We have tens of thousands of Americans at risk, and our assessments have given Iraq chemical and biological capability. So how do we respond? And to me, that's one scenario in which the Bush administration may very well initiate a nuclear weapon, attack Iraq with a nuclear weapon. And to think of the United States again bringing nuclear weapons to bear on the world sickens me. So now to your question, ma'am.
My other question was, why isn't
Okay, the two-part question. One deals with Donald Rumsfeld, and when he was a special envoy of Ronald Reagan to Iraq, he was also involved with pharmaceuticals. Did he profit from that? I have no way of knowing. But I will say this about Rumsfeld's trip. Rumsfeld's trip initiated an exchange of intelligence information between the United States and Iraq. In 1988, I've had the honor, or whatever you want to say, the opportunity to debrief Wafiq Samurai, an Iraqi general who ran the intelligence, the military intelligence division of the Iraqi military responsible for Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. And he was the lead liaison between the Americans and the Iraqis about the exchange of intelligence. And he said, you know, the Americans would come in and put their satellite photographs out there on the table and plot out the Iranian defensive dispositions, and then would sit back while we planned our attack, and we would sit there and talk about the integration of chemical weapons into our attack plan, and the Americans did nothing to stop us. They said nothing. So, you know, Donald Rumsfeld was part of a process which facilitated the Iraqi use of chemical weapons in the 1980s, and, you know, now he's sitting there leading the attack, wanting to go to war against Iraq because they did that, and that's a little bit hypocritical. It's also hypocritical of Dick Cheney to speak about, you know, this maintaining this absolute embargo against Iraq, this economic sanctions, when as the chief executive officer of Halliburton, his company was involved in several multi-million dollar oil refurbishment deals. These aren't illegal deals under Oil for Food. He can do them. They did them through Irish cutouts. But the bottom line is Halliburton profited from a policy of economic engagement with Iraq that Dick Cheney hypocritically condemns. So there's a whole bunch of hypocrisy out there in regards to Iraq, and we should all keep our minds open to that.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you were in, you know, you were an inspector, you were in Iraq. There's a lot of people that are going to Iraq, and it seems like Saddam Hussein has been highly demonized. I just want to know about the people of Iraq.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, the question deals about the people of Iraq and what do they feel.
Right.
And because I was there, what are my perceptions? First of all, I can't tell you what their feeling of Saddam Hussein is, because my job as a weapons inspector was not to go around and interview Iraqi citizens about their feeling of Saddam Hussein. I have my perception of the, and I'll frame it in this way. You know, as Americans, if you look at the media, I mean, we turn on the TV, showdown with Iraq, showdown with Saddam, war with Iraq. And, you know, we've turned this concept of what's going on into entertainment. It's like the world, you know, the World Wrestling Federation, you know, we're going to have the animal come out and fight the Hulk or whatever. And we've also taken a nation of 23 million people of tremendous religious and ethnic diversity, and we've simplified them into the personage of one man, Saddam. We view Iraq as Saddam Hussein. And that's simply not the case. Iraq is composed of 23 million people, human beings just like us. They wake up in the morning, they aspire to the same dreams that we aspire to, they want the same good life for their children, and, you know, they just want to live life. And believe me, most of them would probably want to live life without Saddam Hussein, but they're not going to be willing to sit back and let somebody come in and invade their country and take over their resources. Study history. Do you think on June 1st, 1941, that the people of the Soviet Union loved Joseph Stalin, that they got out there and voluntarily said, "We love you, Uncle Joe"? No, this is a nation that their military was purged, where tens of millions of people were starved, and they had more millions of people in the gulag. Yet when the Germans invaded on June 21st, the people of the Soviet Union rallied in defense of their homeland. And the Iraqis will rally in defense of their homeland because it is their homeland. It's their homes, their towns, their villages, their neighbors. And we have to understand that. They will fight us tooth and nail. But, you know, they're not evil people. I'll just give you two little vignettes. You know, when I was an inspector in Iraq, I was one of the most hated people in Iraq. They showed my photograph on Iraqi TV every night and they called me Abu Azamat, the father of all crises. When I came to Iraq, there was a crisis, and I'm the guy who's responsible for causing all these problems. So on the rare occasions that we had an opportunity to go out with my team and eat dinner in an Iraqi restaurant, we didn't slip in and slip out. They saw us. And one night I was getting eyed by this Iraqi lady. She was just sitting there giving me the evil eye, and I'm going, my alarms are going off. You better get out of here. Something bad's going to happen. She gets up from her table and she walks over and she stares at me. She says, "You're Scott Ritter." And I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "I just want you to know that we know you have a job to do. and we know you're just doing your job. We don't like your job, but we know you're just doing your job, but you need to do one thing for me. And I said, what's that, ma'am? She said, go back to America and tell them we don't hate you. So why do you hate us? And that's a big question. Now, the other thing, I was driving down the highway coming back from an inspection, and a school bus pulls up. We're at a stoplight, and the school bus pulls up, and the teacher sort of looks out, and there again is Abu Azamet's ugly face, and she points, and she gets all her children to rush over the side, and they're all staring down, and they're chanting, down, down, USA, down, down, Bush, down, down, Ritter, screaming it, and I looked up at him, and I waved. And instantly, all the kids start waving back, including the teacher, and the demonstration was over. Ladies and gentlemen, the Iraqi people don't hate us. They're human beings, and we have to find a way to coexist with them as human beings. Yes, sir.
Scott, I was catching the news before I came over here. They said you're actually going to Iraq tomorrow. Is that true?
Yes, I'll be departing for Iraq tomorrow.
And if so, what they mentioned is you're going to be meeting with some government officials. What do you hope to accomplish on this trip, other than the obvious preventing war?
Well, you know, we live in dangerous times right now. And, you know, I have to tell you that I don't want to go to Iraq, because I know that by going up there, I'm just teeing myself up and I'm going to get beat to hell by the media and by those who are proponents of this war. But as an American citizen, I feel that it's my obligation to do everything possible to avoid a war. And because of my unfortunate, unique experience, I am positioned where I can go to Iraq, and I can have meetings with senior Iraqi officials, and I can promote ideas and concepts that can maybe open up alternatives to war. I don't want to prejudge the outcome of this. I don't want to give away too much. I'll be joined by Dennis Halliday, the former humanitarian coordinator for the United Nations in Iraq. I'll be joined by Norman Solomon, the director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and hopefully we'll be joined by some British colleagues. And the goal is to go in and implore the Iraqi government to start creating conditions in which war can be avoided. It's not simply about working with weapons inspectors and cooperating with weapons inspectors. President Bush has said his policy on Iraq is regime change. And to be honest, the only way we're going to stop this war with Iraq is to stop it in Washington, D.C. President Bush is going to have a way to save face on this issue. He has committed so much political capital to the concept of regime change that he can't back away from it. So I'm going to go into Iraq and try and create regime change. But it's going to be done by focusing not on military intervention, but rather imploring that the Iraqis do whatever they can to assist their human rights issues. What can be done to bring the United Nations back into Iraq so that there can be effective monitoring of Iraq's human rights? That would be regime change. I'm going to implore on the Iraqis to build upon their promise of rewriting their constitution to allow opposition parties and to expand on that, maybe to bring in the United Nations to help monitor the creation of opposition parties so that you can have a UN-monitored election 3 years from now for the parliament. That would be regime change. And if things of this nature can take place in concert with weapons inspections and Iraqi cooperation with the inspectors, you know, President Bush opened the door for such a concept of nonviolent resolution, nonviolent regime change last fall when he said, if Iraq fully cooperates with the United Nations demands on weapons inspections, that would be unique in our relationship with Iraq. It would signify a change in the regime. So let's build on that. Maybe it's desperate, but you know, when your boat sinks in the middle of the ocean and you're out there treading water, you know, big waves, and you're waiting for that other ship to come over and rescue you, and you're getting tired and you're getting tired, do you just give up and sink? No. You keep treading water, hopeful that a ship will come in. So maybe my trip to Iraq is simply treading water, and ultimately it's going to fail and I'm going to drown. But you know what? Maybe over there a ship will come in and rescue us and save us from all these problems. Yes, sir. Okay, from my personal experience, what are my observations of the true level of suffering in Iraq as sanctions? Is it true that as many children died as claimed in some of the alternative press? I was a weapons inspector in Iraq. My job was to go into Iraq and hunt down weapons of mass destruction. I wasn't there to implement humanitarian policies. I feel very comfortable talking about weapons inspections. I'm not comfortable providing eyewitness testimony to economic sanctions and level of suffering. But I will say this, Dennis Halliday, the gentleman who's going to be accompanying me, was such an eyewitness, and I have the highest regard for his integrity and in the accuracy of his reportings. And when Dennis Halliday says that there was a period of time in which 5,000 to 6,000 children under the age of 5 were dying every month, I believe Dennis Halliday. He's been to the hospitals. He's seen that situation. And I think we should put it in another perspective. In an effort to disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, we justify the continuation of economic sanctions. You know, in the 20th century, the century of weapons of mass destruction, from World War I up to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there are estimates to say maybe 450,000 people died as a result of the world's use of weapons of mass destruction. To rid Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, justifying economic sanctions, we have killed upwards of 1.5 million Iraqi civilians. So I think we've got this irresponsible fixation on weapons of mass destruction and the threat they pose. When we go around killing three times as many innocent Iraqis to get rid of weapons of mass destruction that died in the century of weapons of mass destruction, there's a distinct problem there. I have time for two more questions. I'll take one in the back. Yes, sir. Well, what I'll say is this. I'm not disputing what you say. I'm not here to enter a debate. I was on the staff that participated in this war. I was one of the planners, and I was involved in targeting. I can tell you, every time we sat down and planned out a target, we had a whole host of military lawyers going through each one. I can tell you that we bent over backwards, from my perspective, to ensure that every time we dropped a bomb, and let's be real here. We're talking about war, ladies and gentlemen. You know what war's about? It ain't tiddlywinks. It's about killing people. We're talking about total war. When we go to war with Iraq, it's not simply bombing their troops in the field. War is about taking it to the enemy. You break their will to fight. That's what we did in the Gulf War. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but my God, when we go to war, we will kill. And we will kill them by the thousands, by the tens of thousands. That's why we should do everything we can to avoid war, because war is so terrible. And we had lawyers looking at the targets. Now, if you're telling me that, who says bullshit about the lawyers? I'm telling you, every target that we bombed, we had a whole host of lawyers looking at it. And the lawyers were there to ensure that the targeting took place within the framework of the Geneva Convention. If you have a problem with the lawyers' findings, that should be investigated. And I would recommend you write your congressman and ask for a complete review of the targeting process. But I'm here to tell you that war is a damn horrible thing, and that people will die in war. Innocent people will die in war, and I'd rather not be debating the sins of why we targeted this and that. I'd rather avoid a situation where we're targeting the Iraqis to begin with. Last question in the back, all the way. Yes, sir.
Yes, I was wondering, in regards to your statements earlier, it almost sounds as if U.S. foreign policy makers dictate what the U.N. does. Yeah. You said it was because the U.S. pulled the inspectors out in 98. Now we tell them to go back. So what is the function of the U.N. then? And the second question is, if you have any contact or any relationships with Iraqi officials or their private citizens, and if you ever received any gifts from them?
Okay, I'll answer the first part first. Do I have any contacts with Iraqi officials or its citizens, and have I ever received any gifts with them? I don't have direct contact. Look, I wouldn't go to Iraq unless there was a vehicle for me to communicate with the Iraqi government to get them to approve the trip. So there is a way that I can communicate with the Iraqi government. It's been reported to the U.S. government. They're fully aware of it. And that's what I have to use to facilitate the trip. Would I ever take a gift from the Iraqi people or the Iraqi government? No. Not at this point in time. That would be something that would, cast aspersions on the credibility and the viability of... Pardon?
Previous.
Never. I would never take monetary gifts or other gifts from Iraq. I'm not here to enrich myself by taking gifts. I'm here to promote a policy of peace and justice for the United States. Two. What was the first question? I'm sorry.
Whether or not U.S. Foreign policymakers dictate.
Okay, to the UN. The United Nations is a collection of nations. It's United Nations. It's a membership. But that membership, when it comes to issues pertaining to international peace and security, the membership is complicated. It requires dues. The members pay dues. The United States happens to... But even when the United States doesn't pay the totality of its dues, understands that we put a lot of money into it, which means we have a lot of influence over the United Nations. We're able to do things such as saying, if you don't play the game by our rules, we'll pull the funding. So we intimidate people. It's a policy of intimidation. On the Security Council, there's five permanent members of the Security Council. And since the collapse of the former Soviet Union as a viable counter to the United States, we're the sole remaining superpower, and we use our status to intimidate the members of the Security Council to the point that we do bully the United Nations, and thereby the United Nations loses its effectiveness. But what we're seeing right now is that the world believes in the United Nations. The world believes in the concept of the United Nations, and while the United States does have the ability to carry out unilateral policies, the world is starting to stand up and reject what the United States is doing, and that's the real danger. We have the Security Council. We have the Security Council beginning to speak with a unified voice against this American policy. So, I'll leave you with this final thought. We speak of Al-Qaeda. The United States here in America, we say Al-Qaeda is the number one threat to international peace and security. Al-Qaeda is the biggest threat out there to the world. Leave the borders of the United States. If I were running the Department of Peace, I would sit there and say, from a national security perspective, I would put forward a policy that issues a passport to every American citizen and gives them a $5,000 cash lump sum to travel outside the borders of the United States and see how the world views us. Because I'll tell you this, the world views the United States as the number one threat to international peace and security. And if we invade Iraq along the lines that President Bush is currently talking about, it's not just a perception, but ladies and gentlemen, I have to tell you, it becomes a reality. We'll become a power that is not reflective of the true promise of America. Thank you very much for coming tonight. It was a pleasure.
Okay, folks, if anybody would like to get a book or get their book signed, I have to ask you to go around this way. All right, go on. I'll let him. We have books at the front. And you can come and ask any other questions and come and meet Scott at the front.
Go ahead, Will.
I can't let many
more.
I can't let people in this way. You go in, that's it. Ma'am, you go in, your husband's in there?
Yes, thank you.
That's it. Everybody has to go around that
way. Where's the line then?
Just go around the store.
You need to get to the register.
Okay.
Pardon me, I need to get through here, please. Excuse me. Pardon me.